You're listening to Save My City, part of the We Love Where You Live podcast series brought to you by the Michigan Municipal League. Here's your host, Tony Mangini.
Today we're joined by Brandon Fournier, who is a partner with Schiffman Law. Brandon is a leader in labor and OPEB issues around the state, and he's been very helpful with the league in their efforts to reform our OPEB costs. Today we're going to be talking about this issue and the complexities associated with that, as well as some of the new requirements that are being passed on to our communities with reporting and corrective action plans. And we're going to talk as well about what are some of the things that we can and should be doing on a go-forward basis here in Michigan. Well, Brandon, thanks for joining us today. OPEB has been a big issue. You and I have been involved in this for, it seems like forever now. But what is OPEB? Why is it such a big deal? Can you kind of just talk a little bit about why this is such an important issue for local government?
Sure. I appreciate it, Tony. Thank you very much for having me. I think your comments about being involved in this for quite a while is kind of an understatement. Since really the onset of the Great Recession, dating back to 2005, is when we first started recalculating how we look at these liabilities, more similar to a pension liability, when the GASB rules changed the first time. Since then, obviously grappling with cash flow crunches as a result of the decrease in property values, retiree health care has become an ever-growing obligation for a multitude of factors.
So let me take you back for a second, because you and I, again, been living this for so long. We say OPEB and we know what that means, but a lot of folks don't. What is OPEB?
Outstanding post-employment benefits, which is a separate category from pension benefits.
So fancy way of saying retiree health care benefits?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And as a result of those benefits, obviously, without getting too deep into the weeds, we have kind of a stability as it relates to retiree health care costs, which changes dramatically in the last 10 or 15 years. And that's really what's been pressuring local governments.
What's driving those costs to get so out of whack?
Obviously, the global health care system, something well without our control. And then the other thing that's happened as well is, retirees are living longer.
That's something that's funny because I go back longer than I want to admit, and healthcare, retiree healthcare included, used to be cheap. And the inflation we've seen with that, and as you point out, people are living longer. The combination of those two things is really having a pretty significant impact.
Yeah, there's no question. Probably back circa 1990, the cost of a family plan in retirement was maybe $100 a month. That's now easily over $1,000 a month. You put that into the vice that local government's been facing as it relates to, statutory revenue as well as property taxes, and you have a real problem, a crisis on your hands.
So for the most part, I mean, I realize it's not a uniform answer, but these dollars that go towards paying these OPEB costs are dollars that are being diverted away from services.
There's no question. I did get the opportunity to drive on the Great Michigan Road System on my way to Ann Arbor this morning. And obviously, the fact that government's been able to hold on or hold the line the last 10 years has avoided our ability to invest in our infrastructure systems. And you put all that together and the retiree costs are a big problem.
So something that I know we've talked a lot about as it relates to this is that also drives this problem. The design of some of these plans is very antiquated. So you might have a system still delivering healthcare the same way they did in 1995.
There's no question about that. The historical kind of perception of retirement benefits is I leave with the healthcare plan that was in effect when I retired. The problem is we've treated that under some sense, but we've also provided every cost and improvement along the way.
So the knife only cuts one way, basically, is
correct.
What I'm hearing you say. And that obviously never is a good situation when you're dealing with things like that. So can you talk a little bit about, what the rules that we're operating under, like what sets the playing field for that? Because that's something that even folks that are in the business, I think, are really fuzzy about in terms of what governs the contract, case law, statutory law. Like, can you kind of walk us through that a little bit?
Happy to do so. Like yourself, Tony, before I went into the legal field, I was actually a city manager. So I had the experience of kind of learning that as I went through that process. And you step into local government and you want to treat and analyze pension retirement health care exactly like you would a pension benefit. In Michigan, as most of us know, pension benefits are protected by Article 9 of the Michigan Constitution. That makes it something that you cannot modify as it relates to unilateral changes by the employer. Back in 2005, the Michigan courts actually addressed this specific issue as it relates to retirement health care benefits, and they determined that under the analysis, they are not protected by Article 9 of the Constitution. And that was a game changer.
So what did that open up for, in terms of the ability to deal with these costs and the structure of these plans?
Once the courts issued that decision, they also stated that those benefits should be treated like any type of contract benefit. As a result, the analysis is looking at the contracts by which people retired. We tend to focus on collective bargaining agreements, but we also have lots of employees who retired under personal service contracts or without a contract at all. And the courts told us that the analysis to look at these benefits, should there be an ability to make change, is predicated upon those individual agreements.
Very complicated issue. So even within a community, it's not a one-size-fits-all. You may have a different answer for one contract than you do for another.
Absolutely. If you're a typical community that has four to five public sector unions, as well as a myriad of individuals who might have retired under an ordinance or a personal service contract, you could have 15 to 20 to 30 documents you have to look at.
Fun. Good times.
If not more.
That'll keep you busy.
Absolutely.
So you say all this stuff, and we talk about the legal tests and things like that. I mean, we're not advocating, though, saying we should get rid of retiree health care. And that's something that I think is important for folks to understand. When we talk about wanting to reform this, what we're really saying is we've got to be smarter in how we deliver some of these things. What's your experience, different ways you've been able to deal with this when you have bargaining units that are willing to come to the table? What are some of the strategies you guys are employing to deal with the cost?
Yeah, to kind of look back in history as to where we got here, obviously in 2011, with the adoption of Public Act 152, that was really a game changer for our active employees.
What was 152?
Public Act 152 placed a hard cap limitation on the amount of money that a local government could pay towards employee health care. There are other options under the statute, but what it did is it created an equity obligation for local government employees to be at the table with management in terms of restructuring costs. After that was adopted, we saw dramatic changes in the plans that were offered to our employees. Not necessarily a decrease in the ultimate access to benefits, but it really changed how we thought about those benefits, how we could find cost mutual ways that would reduce the total cost of the employer and the employee, which would also still allow them the benefits they needed, but changed access points, et cetera. Barring those principles over the last 5 or 6 years, most of the success that we've seen are local units of government that engage in those dialogues with the existing retirees and look at ways to maximize the benefit deployment while also reducing costs. Mm-hmm. And that's specific to each employee group.
Yeah. I mean, I know just firsthand here at the League, in my time here, we've moved from sort of a traditional delivery system to HMOs, and that has brought a significant cost reduction. So it's one of those things, if you don't have a reason to look at it and spend some time with it, you might not understand. It can have a very significant change in the cost structures of that without a real significant reduction in benefits. I mean, you know, my family enjoys pretty good healthcare benefits, but I know, because I'm obviously engaged in the management of those programs, that you can do so with wildly different cost structures on the backside. So I think that is a really important conversation and an important thing for folks to understand. Hey, we're not out there saying, we want to take away everyone's health. That's barbaric, and no one has ever suggested that that we've been associated with. But this is about being smart and how we deliver these things, because there are better ways to deliver that benefit. You know, we've said this a lot, sort of anecdotal or metaphorical, but do you want to drive a Cadillac until it runs out of gas, then you have no benefit, or would you rather, you know, drive a Chevy for the rest of your life? And I think that's kind of what we've got to reorient ourselves towards. We're trying to make these benefits sustainable, mm-hmm. For the long term. We have seen what happens when people aren't willing to accept and take on the issue and recognize that you can't afford the benefit that you have. We've seen communities go from a very, very rich benefit to no benefit. And I don't think that serves anyone's purposes.
No, and that's the tragic situation. I mean, we at the League obviously understand, and in my role representing a myriad of communities, when you're making a 25 and a 30-year employment commitment to an employer, you expect something in return, and the employer wants to provide those benefits. The problem is healthcare today looks nothing like it did 20 years ago, and the costs have exploded beyond control. And as a result of those combination of factors, looking at reforming benefits in a mutually beneficial way is definitely the appropriate approach.
Yep. No, I totally agree with that. You know, we talk about that knife cut in both ways, and you kind of touched on it just a second ago. When we talk about we have to follow the contract, we've got this old contract and they want us to follow that, we want those benefits. What we're really saying is we want those deductibles, we want those copay amounts that are no longer really available. But what they're really saying is I want 2018 healthcare with the structure of a 1995 plan. And those two things don't go together. So one of the things that we've sort of advocated for is to say, look, if you want 2018 healthcare, you got to have a 2018 healthcare design. If we were to say to someone, okay, we're going to give you 1995 healthcare, both the deductibles and the medical technologies that were available, which means we don't have some of the drugs we have, there's no 3D CAT scans and all the different things that we all enjoy now that are allowing us to live longer and enjoy, you know, more fruitful lives. No one wants to sign up for that. And so that's the part I think we got to realize, that the cost structures that those plans were relied upon are no longer there. And that's because we're offering these incredibly amazing advancements that have occurred in medicine. And so we got to look at this thing from both sides of this and create something that works not just for the community, but for the employee and for everyone involved with this.
No, I completely agree. You know, we've spent a lot of time talking about this, Tony, with other representatives of the MML. Ultimately, when you look back at a 1995 collective bargaining agreement, it's easy to get kind of caught in technical speak when you're looking at these issues. But and you look at the drug formulary benefits provided to the employees at the time, it's probably 2 pages in length. You know, now it's probably 2,000 pages in length, and it's a growing, breathing document. As new drug advances take place, then the employees and retirees are afforded the benefit to those drugs. But when you're on a $2 drug copay, because that's what existed in 1995, obviously that doesn't fit into the modern structure.
Yeah. I mean, some of them didn't even have the requirement to use generic drugs. I mean, so there's a lot of those things that are out there that just, they're game changers. People don't realize the impact those can have. There was a community, I can't remember which community it was off the top of my head, actually. I think it might've been Howell or Brighton. A simple change in their drug card saved them like $150,000 a year. I mean, so these cost adjustments can be very significant.
Yeah, there's no question about that. It's funny you mentioned a term just a moment ago, generic drugs. I'm not even sure that term would have been in the nomenclature in, you know, the early 1990s when a lot of our present retirees were ending their careers with their local governments. Now that's become, you know, a key access point to being able to control cost, utilization of generic step therapy. You know, some of the great ways that people have dealt with these issues when they look at those old pharmaceutical benefits is to say, I know you have a $2 copay system, but what I'm going to do is modernize that in terms of giving you a 0-40-80. So there's still an advantage to the retiree, but there's also some sort of equity cost structure that helps offset the cost of those drugs.
So let me ask you a broader question here. So give plus or minus $1 billion, you know, amongst friends here, we got about $11 billion unfunded obligation for OPEB benefits. Local government just not have their eye on the ball. Like, how do we find ourselves where we are today?
You know, we touched on earlier in our conversation. Look at, again, I hate going back in the time machine, but look at the cost of retiree healthcare or healthcare in the, you know, late 1980s up to the mid 1990s. That was an insignificant factor for local government. They're able to pay those costs through cash flow. The retiree base was a relatively small component and the costs were small. What happens over the last 20 years is costs explode, and ultimately the benefits being provided are more costly. Our retirees are generally taking over our active populations that still provide these benefits. Again, these were standard benefits offered back in that previous era that no current employers generally do provide because of the cost and long-term obligations for the employer. So you put those factors together and ultimately it leads to this present situation. I did mention when we first started, back in 2005 is when GASB really changed the standard for the first time, which said you have to calculate the cost of this outstanding liability. And that was the first time that local government actually was confronted with that total liability figure in that in the present format.
Yeah, it's interesting because you sort of think you always knew, but as you point out, we didn't. And neither did private business. I mean, they had for a long time no recognition of this. I remember when GM had to book several billion dollars and it was like a big aha moment for them, and they immediately got out of the business. We don't really have that opportunity or option. But, you know, it reminds me of something when you talk about this. And we have, in contrast to maybe a private business environment, lower retirement ages. And you might say, well, why is that? And the answer typically you'll get is, well, you don't want, you know, bad guys being chased by, you know, someone 60 years old. And I get that. I'm getting close to that number, so I get that. And I don't want to be chasing bad guys either. So it makes sense. But what that means is we're providing that benefit for a very long horizon, even before they get to Social Security and Medicare ages. So the burden that we're carrying is a lot longer as well. So that, I think, is a huge component of it. And when you sort of play that out over generations, I can recall my first sort of real job when I was working for the city of Melvindale, going to my boss and saying, hey, I'm looking at these numbers here and I can see where there's going to be a day where we're going to have more retirees than active employees. And he kind of dismissed me as, you know, yeah, I get it. That's crazy talk. Well, not only has that come to pass, there are some communities, two, three, and state treasury even offer, there's a community out there with six retirees for every employee. And that's just an unsustainable number. So when you think about, you're paying healthcare for those six employees plus the active employees. And that's just not a sustainable situation. So this reform talk is absolutely necessary. This isn't just some, you know, fad thing we're talking about in the here and now. This is something that's going to really affect, I think, our long-term prosperity for, as a community and as a state as we go forward. So I want to shift gears a little bit here. You and I were spending so much time together back in the end of the legislature. It was a wonderful time. I miss you terribly. I thought we were going to spend Christmas together at some point. I wasn't sure if it would be at your house or my house, but we put a lot of time into the legislature was dealing with this issue. I think it was a little bit of a dribbler, you know, maybe we beat out to first, but I think there was an opportunity to hit a home run that we missed. But I know you have thoughts about this as well. Can you talk a little bit about what happened last fall and what the requirements are now, just in a broad sense, not, you know, a lot of detail, but
sure. As most of our listeners will remember back, I guess it would be over a year ago is when they first tried to put forth an OPEB reform bill. And that was stalled. And ultimately the governor formed a task force, represented by multiple interests to try to discuss these issues. That report was ultimately published, in late summer, early fall of 2017. And with that information, the legislature started discussing these issues. The ultimate result is a change, no question. It's a primary focus on reporting measures. But for the first time since I've been doing this, and I think we're ahead of many states on this, we have pretty hard and fast reporting requirements as it relates to the retiree healthcare side. Pension is a longstanding obligation, and there's a history of that. But with this comes the obligation to create corrective action plans. It was a very challenging effort that we were obviously heavily engaged in. There's a diverse range of ideas on how to deal with this, and I think the MML has a very competent, balanced approach that focuses on, you know, dealing with those most distressed communities and finding mutually beneficial ways to reform the cost of the benefits so that benefit could still ultimately be provided. So we're in the first phase of reporting, which took place about a month ago. Many of our communities have received letters from Treasury being notified that they actually hit the trigger. Mm-hmm. And as a result, we're in the process of formulating corrective action plans.
Yeah, so everyone's got to do it. Basically, all local governments have to report this information. Then Treasury's taking a look at it and saying, based on what you've submitted, you've either triggered or not triggered. It's based on a number of factors. We won't get into all the laundry list of things. But so if you trigger, as you point out, you've got to do this corrective action plan. What does that entail? Like, what are they looking for in that?
Presently, it's kind of a synopsis. Right now, you can seek a waiver. That's the period of time that we're in.
Well, that's a great point. We should probably talk first about the waiver. Well, so, about the waivers.
So if you hit the trigger on the pension or the healthcare side, now you're in the opportunity phase where you can file a waiver request for either of those systems, be it pension or retiree healthcare. And essentially in that waiver request, you just have to put forth a plan or a summary of reasons why you'll be outside of the trigger requirements within a reasonable amount of time. Obviously, for some of our communities in certain situations, that's a realistic, attainable goal. If my pension system's funded at 55%, maybe I can raise that to the necessary 60%. For many of our communities, though, certainly on the healthcare side, raising it up to 40% or reducing the annual spend is a much more complicated factor. So they'll find themselves focused in on the corrective action plan phase probably within the next month or so.
Okay, great. I know when we first went into this, they were saying, we're only going to have, you know, maybe 20 places trigger. We thought it'd be a real small number. We're well over 100 communities that have triggered this. So I think as we've been trying to get them to understand, this is a bigger and broader issue than maybe they realize. Now, I think a lot of those might qualify for those waivers we talked about. But I do think it really highlights that this is a real issue. It's an important issue. And if we don't deal with it in a meaningful way, it does have the potential to really undermine a lot of the other things that we're doing on trying to move this state forward. So we're certainly want to continue to work on this issue. Kind of in that vein, like I said, this was sort of a first step. in my mind, what we did last fall, we were seeking broader reforms. We were seeking to clarify powers and, you know, make sure that people understand what we can and cannot do, because this is an issue that we want to try to deal with. From your perspective, if you could wave a magic wand and say, you know, we're going to do all the things we'd like to see happen, what is still needed from the state as a partner in this?
I think real clarity on the ability to modernize benefits continues to remain the most significant outstanding component part. I mean, identifying the problem was very helpful, obviously. Being able to annually report the problem in a meaningful way, in my opinion, the problem with the previous reporting system is it didn't focus on the annual cash flow spend. It didn't show each year how much money was being diverted from roads and investment into retiree health care. Now we have a system that's going to allow us to see that on an annual basis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know that was something we really pushed hard on was, it's great to know what your sort of total unfunded number is, but what about the affordability of this? Because the impact really on a budgetary standpoint is that, can I afford it or can I not? And so that's something we put a lot of energy behind. So when you talk about clarifying what we can and can't do, what governs that now?
Well, presently, the entire body of issues that we're dealing with is really kind of a conglomeration, a myriad of various case law that's been developed in the federal courts as well as in certain Michigan courts. We discussed earlier this morning kind of a critical pending case that's taking place right now at the Michigan Supreme Court. Macomb County made some changes with its retirement health care benefits, and this issue has recently been heard by our Supreme Court justices, and the issue will be decided. But there's not a perfect line of conclusion as it relates to each local government on how to deal with these changes based upon these case rulings.
And so, again, if we were able to codify that into law, that'd be helpful, right? Because as a former city manager, and you know, we both used to be on that side of the world, understanding what you can and can't do is really important, right? You don't want to misstep and spend the next 3 years in court fighting about things and doing things. And as an employee, you want to have the same understanding as well. So understanding sort of the rules of engagement is really beneficial for everybody, as opposed to this sort of case law approach.
Yeah, the problem with our present system is I can be in a situation where I feel I need to make these changes for the purposes of my local government sustainability, and then I'm going to find myself in a court battle for, you know, 5, 6, or even, you know, 7 years. During that time, I'm running a lot of costs as it relates to legal fees. In some cases, judges do grant restraining orders, which prevents those changes from taking place while this court litigation is ongoing. So you can go through a prolonged period where you're not accruing any savings, you're not improving the benefits, the lives of your active employees or your retirees, and you're also incurring a lot of costs. And at the end of the road, who knows what the ultimate result's going to be?
And that's
uncertainty.
And that's the scariest part, I think, right? You're doing all this on a, fingers crossed, I hope this works
Absolutely.
Out the way I had planned. So, you know, I really appreciate you've done a ton of work on this stuff. And, you know, I would like to just thank you for all you've done
on
behalf of the league and on your clients out there, because this is such a huge issue and it's not a fun issue. It's a very personal issue. People get very passionate about it, which I get. You know, I know I've had family members that have dealt with this in their own way where they've lost their health benefits. So I understand the impacts these can have on folks. And that's why we've tried to be very thoughtful in the positions we've been advocating for, say, no, the last thing we want to do is sort of strip away benefits. But we've all got to recognize we've got to be able to do this in a sustainable way. And if we can't do it that way, it's to nobody's benefit. And so I know there's going to be a lot more conversation in the months and years to come about this issue, because it's not gone away. We're going to, I think hopefully what comes out of this first round of reporting is we're now really, really getting our arms around the magnitude of this problem, and maybe we can start to have some of the more meaningful conversations that we were really working hard on all of last fall, so we can spend more time together. And that's really the most important thing right now.
Yeah, that is important. And, you know, in harping on the comments that you just made, Tony, in terms of what we've experienced, not only through our efforts legislatively dealing with labor leaders and also on a local level as it relates to specific communities, most folks that engage in this dialogue and conversation understand the problem. And I think most people want to see the fix, which is ultimately ensuring that those retirees are provided health care in an affordable, meaningful way. And engaging in a dialogue presently is critically important, because I think you said earlier very astutely, keeping the system healthy is the most important thing for retirees. And our continued ability to provide these benefits is the thing that is going to ensure that we can continue to do this for perpetual generations as those benefits are called upon.
I think that's a great way to end it right there, because I think that's exactly the key point that we want to leave on. We want to be able to sustain this so that we can all rely on it and have some confidence in what we're doing. So, Brandon, thanks so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Tony.
This has been a production of the Michigan Municipal League. For more information on our programs and services, please visit www.mml.org and join us for the next episode of We Love Where You Live.